Superman first encountered Santa Claus in 1940's Superman's Christmas Adventure, written by Superman co-creator Jerry Siegel and illustrated by Jack Burnley. The plot, which was very characteristic of early progressive Superman comics, surrounded two crooks who were trying to manipulate Santa into turning his gift-giving enterprise into a for-profit company. Neither Santa nor proto-socialist Superman were down with that. Christmas has had a persistent, if uncomfortable, relationship with superheroes ever since. Superman's most notable encounter with Santa may have been in DC Comics Presents 1967, published in 1984 with a story by Len Wein and art by classic Superman artist Kurt Swan. This adventure involves Superman and Santa foiling a Yuletide scheme by Toy Man while making sure that the good children of the world still got their presents on time. The most jarring element of this comic, to me at least, is that Superman is baffled and incredulous about Santa actually existing. Considering how impossible Superman is himself, it's a bit of a reach for him to be skeptical about Santa. Oddly enough, this incredulity is less prevalent in the Marvel Universe, which is ostensibly more grounded, at least the way Stan Lee pitches it. Everyone from Deadpool to Thor to the Punisher accepts that Santa is as real as gravity, apple pie, and planet-devouring demigods who sport purple tuning fork helmets. Now, the superhero genre isn't the most conducive idiom for seasonal specials. They usually don't have fistfights, but the superhero is malleable above all else. A meld of various pulp genres to begin with, superheroes tend to live in elastic realities where all myths are true. Spider-Man will fight pirates in one issue and then be punching vampires on the moon the following month, so why not have him hang out with Santa? He already knows Thor. That being said, I think the most effective attempts at telling Christmas superhero stories were done in the DC Animated Universe by Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, and the various animators, directors, and voice actors throughout the exceptional run of those programs, starting with Batman the Animated Series and concluding with Justice League Unlimited. We'll be spotlighting three holiday episodes from that era in this recording. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. Alright, this is another episode where we had something else planned, but Sarah and Sylvan had to drop out, so we had to cobble something together last minute, and I didn't really need to do too much research on this. I already have way too many opinions about frickin' Batman. Joining me on this one is my sister Cheryl.
Hello!
And Jacinta's here as well.
Hey-ho!
This is the first time in a while that both of you have seen these episodes, if ever. I think Jacinta didn't remember most of it.
I remembered the Joker episode. I may or may not have seen the second one, and I definitely didn't see the Justice League one until today.
And you are fond of the Martian Manhunter, and he's very cuddly in that episode.
Oh, I loved him so much. I wanted to hug him.
Cheryl, you revisited Justice League Unlimited recently, but none of the other shows as much.
I mean, I do rewatch Batman the Animated Series, but I don't really go for the Christmas New Year's specials, but yeah, I haven't seen Justice League in like a decade.
Any takeaways you've had from these revisits?
I mean, the shopping special is still like my favorite Batman episode. It's just great. I feel like that explains all of everybody's love for Harley Quinn right there.
Pianos.
No, it's fun. Commissioner Gordon's a lot cuter than I remember.
I mean, if you're going to ask me, like, my favorite iteration of whatever DC character, it's almost always going to be the version from the DC Animated Universe, whatever it is, but also Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be so good if they would just, like, turn those episodes into the movies, and we could just see that live action.
You don't need to tell me, like, yeah, if you have the animated people start writing and producing the live action movies, I would jump for joy. That is an obvious take.
We would finally have a good live-action movie. I'm sorry, that's terrible. I do enjoy the movies. I just feel like it would have the spirit I want.
You enjoy the DC movies that are coming out
right now? No, not the ones currently.
I liked Blue Beetle.
But I can't say, like, all the Batman movies are bad. Just, you know, only some of them are good.
The first episode we're talking about is Christmas with the Joker, Batman the Animated Series, Season 1, Episode 2, first airing in 1992. Plot for this one is that on Christmas Eve, the Joker escapes from Arkham Asylum using a rocket hidden inside a Christmas tree. Cheryl enjoys that they don't even bother to explain how he got a rocket into that Christmas tree.
Because they know they don't have to. It's just too joyous when he puts the star on his head and rockets away. I'm like, I don't even care how he lands.
And he waves goodbye to Charles Manson right before he does it.
Singing Jingle Bells, Batman smells.
I don't care about any of it. That's all amazing. Nobody explained it to me. You don't. It's just perfect as it is. Also, that eyeliner, damn.
Batman and Robin begin patrolling Gotham City to search for him, with Robin being skeptical of this particular patrol being worthwhile, opting to relax and get into the holiday spirit at Wayne Manor and watching It's a Wonderful Life, figuring that, like Will Eisner's The Spirit, they will not be necessary on Christmas Eve because of the Christmas spirit.
Oh, wait, I have a timeline question.
Yep.
So you said that earlier when we were watching it, this is, like, episode 2 of season 1?
Yes, and it's one of the first episodes that they animated, and boy does that show.
Oh, seriously.
The character designs are real awkward, especially for like the random passerbys and pedestrians.
Yeah, but my timeline question is, I remember the flying Graysons dying. Was that in flashbacks?
That was in flashbacks.
Okay, because I'm like, how did they do that one? That's tricky.
That is something to talk about on a different episode, and oh boy, would Sylvan be mad if we left him out of that one. I mean, Sylvan's gonna be mad that we left him out of this one. But anyways, after finding Gotham to be uncharacteristically peaceful, the dynamic duo returned to Wayne Manor and discovered that the Joker has hijacked Gotham's television signals. Sporting a big old Bing Crosby sweater, he announces that he is going to broadcast his assault on Gotham City as a Christmas special. Joker is speaking to a live studio audience consisting of cardboard cutouts of Gotham's various public servants, including Batman and Robin themselves.
Do you think that the Joker drew that, or he kidnapped somebody long enough to make them make all of those cardboard cutouts?
I bet he did it himself because it's just that important to him.
I'm fine with that. I mean, he did do a really good hand puppet.
Joker tells the camera that because he does not have a family to spend the holidays with, he has kidnapped Commissioner Gordon, TV reporter Summer Gleason, and Harvey Bullock to serve as one. Joker then tells the camera that if Batman is unable to track him down by midnight, he will execute his three hostages.
Found family, Ryan. Just found family.
Yeah, he found them, bound them, gagged them.
Okay, can I just point out that he gagged them by putting a candy cane in their mouth? And the candy cane was not wrapped around their head with a string or anything. It was just in their mouth, and they chose to be gagged.
Special Joker venom.
Are you gonna engage with the Joker? If he puts a candy cane in my mouth and that's supposed to, like, silence me, it silences me. Move on. But pay attention to someone else.
But then when he took it out, they said their peace and then went silent again when the candy cane went in their mouth.
You gotta play into his logic.
Only Terry McGinnis has the gall to banter with the Joker.
I feel like I would definitely die if I met the Joker. 100%.
Using the Batcomputer, Batman accesses Gotham's electrical mainframe and pinpoints the location of Joker's broadcast signal by tracking the power surges. Joker's hired thugs, Donner and Blitzen, blow up one of Gotham's bridges just as the 11:30 train is about to cross. Summer Gleason's mother is on that train, prompting a taunt from the Joker. Batman and Robin just do a huge-ass U-turn and hurry to intercept the train, with Robin uncoupling the passenger cars and Batman rescuing the engineer just before the train careens off the tracks. Batman then determines that the Joker's signal is coming from the observatory at the top of Mount Gotham. They then head to the top of the mountain and discover a radio transmitter left behind. The Joker reveals that he has replaced the observatory's telescope with a cannon at that point, which he fires upon Batman and Robin, but it goes out of control and just starts firing wildly into the city. As Batman draws the cannon's fire as best he can, Robin breaks into the observatory to disable it. Upon entering, Robin discovers a number of Joker robots with gun fingers, and he just sort of dances around them while destroying them, and neutralizes the cannon with a detonator, throwing a grenade with his little David and Goliath sling.
I loved it! Just...
Joker then gives the dynamic duo a clue to his hideout by broadcasting footage of Summer Gleason opening a Betty blooper doll. Batman recalls that the dolls are no longer sold and that they were last produced at the abandoned toy factory Lafco, which they really should have searched first.
But also, too, I really appreciate that he had that knowledge because at this point they haven't established that he just has a bunch of useless things memorized. So I choose to believe that he is in fact a doll collector. There's a whole room in the mansion just full of dolls.
I think it's related to his bad guys. Like, one of Batman's recurring villains is the Film Freak, so Batman has a comprehensive knowledge of American cinema.
I'm on board with it.
But yeah, this is an abandoned toy factory with a giant decrepit clown face on the infrastructure. Like, there are only so many of those.
How is this not the first place they looked for the Joker?
I mean, then it also made me think, like, the Gotham Opera Company, like, how long did it take for them to, like, establish a no Pagliacci policy?
But how long do you think it'll take for, like, a renegade opera company to be like, all Pagliacci?
Hey, DC Comics, Cheryl and I are available. Anyways, once they enter the factory, Joker, who has anticipated their arrival at this point, sends out several giant robot nutcracker soldiers, which Batman and Robin dispose of with characteristic ease. Then a bunch of toy planes are dispatched relatively quickly. Batman uses a bat for that. Donner and Blitzen suddenly appear with machine guns and begin firing upon the duo, but Batman ascends to a higher level and incapacitates them with a giant teddy bear. After that, Batman leaps to the ground, telling Robin to keep an eye out for the Joker. Suddenly, a large pair of curtains are drawn back, revealing Joker, who has Gordon, Gleason, and Bullock dangling over a vat of hot molten plastic. Joker threatens to cut the rope holding them hostage unless Batman opens a present, which has Batman wrapping paper on it, because the Joker has an attention to detail in this iteration.
There's plenty of flair there. It's delightful.
Yeah, Batman opens the package while Robin cautions him not to. He expects it to be a bomb, but it's just a pie that hits Batman in the face.
Because Batman is his family. He needed to be with him on Christmas.
Yeah, Batman wipes the cream off his suit without altering his stoic expression whatsoever. Joker cuts the rope, but Batman rescues them in time, and then apprehends the Joker. This episode ends with the Joker in a straitjacket in Arkham Asylum singing Jingle Bells Batman Spells and just laughing hysterically into nothing in particular.
You know, Arkham Asylum, I'm very disappointed, did leave him with his shoelaces.
Yeah, he kept the spats.
Yeah.
I just thought it was nice that Batman finally got to watch It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, he can never get past the title, which is the best line in the episode.
It is one of those banger Batman lines that sticks with you.
All right, production for this episode is very challenging. The script was by Eddie Gorodetsky, a friend of writer-producer Paul Dini. Gorodetsky's only Batman episode, this turned out. His prior credits included SCTV, David Letterman, Saturday Night Live, and the ALF cartoon. He would later fall into Chuck Lorre's team, writing scripts for Dharma and Greg, Two and a Half Men, Mom, and The Big Bang Theory. He was also the producer for Bob Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour. Director Kent Butterworth left midway through this episode to accept the job at Universal Studios.
Rude!
According to producer Bruce Timm, Gorodetsky ghost-directed much of the episode while on the layout stage. I think that is one of the main reasons why the art direction for this is as inconsistent as it is. There are definitely rough episodes throughout the first season of Batman the Animated Series, but this is noticeably much hinkier looking than even the pilot episode on Leather Wings with the Man-Bat.
The Man-Bat.
And there are things they haven't figured out yet, like when Batman and Robin are swinging through the city, they throw their batarangs instead of launching them out of, like, little air pressure control things.
Yeah, I really liked, though, the Jack-in-the-Box Joker, that thing that pops up, because it looks like the old comic book one.
And the Joker has this weird, rubbery, very expressionistic face, but there are definitely elements that are already in place, like that train had that Art Deco midnight design that Tim lifted from the Fleischer Superman shorts from the 40s. And I also really like the snow-covered trees when they're at Mount Gotham. It has this like minimalist but also Art Nouveau vibe that made me think of Mary Blair's designs for the 1950s Cinderella.
I was waiting for you to say that. I was thinking the same thing. You can see the little veins coming through, little bushes. That was so cool.
Yeah.
There was actually something about the train that caught my attention that I thought was interesting. So as it was going around the curve, the parts of the train that should have been straight were also curving.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but I really enjoy that it felt like old Mickey Mouse cartoons.
Despite the fact that he walked off mid-episode, this did not hurt Butterworth's long-term relationship with Warner Brothers. He's been an animation timer on most of their direct-to-streaming or DVD cartoons throughout the 2010s. He's credited on everything from Batman vs. the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to Venture Brothers' Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart.
I just watched that yesterday! It was so so good. Sorry, keep going.
This was one of several episodes where Tim Curry recorded dialogue as the Joker.
No! It's still creepy in my brain.
I want to hear it.
I don't.
Accounts vary over why Curry was replaced. According to Tim Curry himself, a laryngitis bout spurred Warner Brothers to find another actor. According to producers, Curry's voice was deemed too scary in focus groups. Children would cry while watching the episodes.
I agree with that one. That would have been horrifying. Hexus was enough of a trauma from my childhood. Thank you.
Footage recently leaked of Curry doing his Joker voice over the animation, and he is doing his Pennywise voice.
No! Does his laugh sound like that?
A little bit. I wasn't a fan of it.
Because I do like the old-looking Joker when he has the, like, hee-hee-hee, but then it's like a Dick Tracy kind of thing, too.
Like, I think there's a good version of Curry doing the Joker. Like, in my mind, the ideal version is just a more manic version of his Rocky Horror performance, but no, he went with Pennywise.
Mm-mm.
John Glover auditioned for the Joker and almost got the part. Tim would later cast him as the Riddler in season 2.
I mean, he does a good Riddler.
Yeah, he's also good in Smallville as Lex Luthor's dad.
I only ever watched like 3 episodes of Smallville.
Yeah, I've only seen the Booster Gold episode of Smallville, and that made my day.
Mark Hamill, when he found out that they were making a Batman cartoon, just showed up unannounced and asked if he could be the Joker.
Yay!
He was very disappointed when they told him that they had already cast Tim Curry as the Joker, but he was like, well, if you can think of another character for me to play, just get in touch with me. So they asked him to come in and audition for the Joker, and casting director Andrea Romano decided upon him because she really liked his laugh.
Which is such an iconic laugh, it's so good!
Hamill views the Joker laugh as a musical instrument in a way. He developed several cackles that were intended to evince the Joker's mood in different positions throughout scenes.
That's amazing.
Hamill had to align his voice to the completed animation, which is the opposite of how things are usually done, because, you know, Tim Curry recorded the voice and then they animated the mouth flaps based on Curry's reading. So Hamill had to work within that for those 3 episodes. Mark Hamill has cited Christmas with the Joker as his favorite episode of the show.
It was very fun. It's very whimsical. Like when he pulls the cardigan off and there's just dancing out of it.
That was a nice touch.
Cardigan on a cardigan, man!
Once again, there are awkward bits to this, but there are also bits that really work in that cardigan.
It was delightful.
Speaking of casting changes, Alfred was voiced by Clive Revell, a New Zealand character actor in the first 3 episodes of Batman the Animated Series. He only has 2 lines in this, and then Charles is like, what's up with Alfred's voice?
He was sick. It sounded very congested, that's all.
Revell got a Golden Globe nomination for his role in Avanti, and he voiced the Emperor in the original theatrical cut of The Empire Strikes Back, so this isn't the first time he got replaced by a more well-known actor. Revell would get replaced by Warner Brothers lifer Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., who would voice Alfred for the rest of the existence of the DC Animated Universe.
I mean, I grew up with that Alfred, so it's the right one in my brain.
Same, I was like, well, that was the right choice.
I mean, I like every Alfred. I like Alfred in the Adam West show, I like Alfred here, I like Alfred in the Tim Burton movies. There's never been a bad Alfred as far as I can tell.
Who is your, like, ideal Alfred, like, if you had to have a new one cast?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, usually I was just like a guy in his 60s or older who could have conceivably played Batman when he was 25.
I want old man Jude Law to be the next Alfred.
Oh my God.
I could see that.
Right? Isn't that kind of like, he seems like he could have been a spy at one point.
And I think he could have been Batman in 1998.
I could see that. Okay.
That's the next movie, DC. That's what you throw your money into.
In addition to being the first episode with the Joker, this is the first episode with Robin, who is voiced by Lauren Lester here. Robin is not especially prominent in the first 2 seasons of Batman the Animated Series, but he gets co-billing in season 3, retitled The Adventures of Batman and Robin. I'm not 100% sure why. I think, at least I'm just speculating here, that the producers were a little squeamish about including Robin, and when they did, they aged him up, so he's like basically a college student. He appears to be about 19 or so. Batman the Animated Series was created during a period where, amongst the fan community and amongst Batman editors in the comics, Robin was considered a bit corny and unnecessary. Batman was very much alone in the Tim Burton movies, and as I mentioned on the podcast episode about Batman Returns, Robin was written into the script for both of those films and then written out after the development stage. Speaking purely for myself, I am very pro-Robin. I consider Robin to be the second most important character in the Batman mythos. As Bill Finger put it when he created Robin, it is just so much easier to move the story along if Batman just has someone to talk to.
Right? Like, can you imagine? Like, I don't know, I just don't like Batman with... I like the Bat family a lot.
Yeah, I like when, you know, you got your grim, stoic Batman and his little sunshine guy standing next to him, just cracking jokes and egging him on.
Right? I feel like you need someone to go with the straight man, and that's what Robin's for.
Yeah, I mean, that or Alfred.
Or both. Both are good.
Alfred can't be standing on the rooftop next to Batman.
What's Alfred's superhero alias? I can never remember it.
Oh, Macaroni.
Yeah.
What? I don't know about this.
That's from the Harley Quinn show.
I need to catch up on that. It's so good.
Bruce Timm considers Christmas with the Joker to be one of the weirder episodes, and despite getting copious notes from Fox Kids censors, it came one of the nastiest, even after all the edits. He was amused that Fox routinely re-aired it on December like clockwork.
Ha.
That's why I knew I'd seen that one. That one was, like, clear in my memories.
All right, the next one we are talking about is Holiday Nights, which is from the New Batman Adventures. It is the very first episode, and it's Christmas-themed despite being aired in September. And it was first broadcast on the WB network in 1997. This one is an anthology with several different plots. The first one takes place on December 22nd. It opens with Harley Quinn bemoaning her fate to her friend Poison Ivy as they stay holed up in a scuzzy hotel with nothing to celebrate the holidays. Harley is eager to get a Christmas tree, but Ivy refuses to support the botanical genocide that happens in America every December. With a raised eyebrow of devious foreboding, Ivy assures Harley that she has a plan that will make it the best Christmas ever. Later on, at the Vreeland estate, we see Bruce having a pleasant conversation with fellow socialite Veronica about forthcoming vacation plans. However, much to Bruce's chagrin, the quiet moment is interrupted by a bunch of bimbos who notice that he is standing under the mistletoe.
So I would like to point out that Veronica led him over there. So she was clearly bored and was just like, oh yes.
I think they could have done more with Veronica Vreeland than they did over the course of the series. She's fun.
Yeah, she was pretty delightful in the little bits that you get of her.
Bruce retreats into the arms of a shadowy female figure who, seizing him by his necktie, plants a kiss right on his mouth.
Sorry, question for you. So, I mean, I'm going to spoil it. I'm going to do the reveal. As a kid, I always thought it was Poison Ivy, but now as an adult, I think it might be Harley Quinn.
I mean, I still think it was Ivy the first time, and then, like, Harley was supposed to just give him another one. Although, yeah, Harley does like to find excuses to kiss Batman.
Right?
And I feel like the lipstick was closer to the color that Harley would wear.
Mm. Finding himself completely out of sorts, he makes his way outside to head home, but is interrupted by Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn in a limo. He then finds himself unable to resist every single command that they give him, no matter how hard he tries. Because that lipstick was some kind of mind control Poison Ivy chemical thing. While in the car, Harley reveals that they intend to take him on a shopping spree where he's just going to use his fat bank account to purchase every item that they want, which sets up a delightful montage where they just wander through various shopping centers, Tiffany's type places, and try on various clothes, with Bruce becoming more and more angry as it comes across. I laugh every single time we close up on his face as he's signing those checks.
He's like, I'm putting a stop on this one, putting a stop on that one.
Expression just gets more and more disgruntled with every time he signs his name.
And the way the music syncs up to it.
And, like, I think he looks even more, like, expressive when you compare him to, like, the cab driver who's also, like, just zonked out the whole time. It's like, oh, Batman is fighting this.
Yeah, I feel like the cab driver is just like, and this is my life now.
I mean, 30 seconds into this, Cheryl is just like, wow, the art direction is so much better. They've learned so much since 1992.
There's so many different angles. When Poison Ivy talks about how they're going to have the best Christmas ever, it, like, zooms in and all you'd get to really see is, like, the arch of her brow. And I'm like, whoa.
Anyways, Bruce finally builds up a will as the chemical's potency begins to wane, vocalizing his dismay. I'm reading off the DC wiki, so that wasn't me. The girls decide to give him another dose, backing away from Harley's approach, however. Bruce falls down a open elevator shaft, believing that he has died in the fall. Harley and Ivy just brusquely leave Bruce for dead, and they turn their backs as they walk away. Of course, Bruce is Batman, so that was a bad idea. As the duo run away from the department store, the silhouette of Batman can be seen swooping after them. When Harley spots him through the back window, Ivy tries to escape by just swerving the car into the toy store. Probing through the black with his flashlight, Batman is ambushed by Harley and Ivy, but he ends up getting the best of them, trapping them under a Christmas tree display. Ivy, very bemused and angry, asks Harley if she is happy now, and Harley, now with the Christmas tree, is sort of into it, yeah.
We have to point out that at the beginning of the episode, their conversation about Christmas started with Harley desperately wanting a Christmas tree.
Yep. All right, the next vignette takes place on December 24th. In Mayfield's department store, Barbara is purchasing a new tie for her father when all of a sudden an ear-piercing wail cuts through the air. The shop attendant by Barbara comments that the kids have been crying all day. Well, I'm used to kids being scared of Santa, but this is ridiculous. Barbara then realizes that Santa is an undercover Harvey Bullock with Montoya as one of his elves.
I love the way that they draw him, because even in the Santa suit, he still looks incredibly sweaty.
Yeah, they're on a stakeout to capture an invisible shoplifter. Bullock does not enjoy playing Santa, but shows rare sensitivity when he unexpectedly meets a young girl whose father he had put in prison. Although he can't do anything to bring Mad Dog home, he gives her some cash to soothe her Christmastime woes, encouraging her to buy a gift for her father as long as it isn't a hacksaw. Barbara, walking through the store, happens to spot a child shoplifting, but when she tries to apprehend him, his clothes and hands just seem to dissolve into paste. Then Montoya gets a call through her earpiece that detectives are in pursuit of four child bandits in the store. Just when the children seem to be cornered, they meld together into Clayface. He begins tearing up the place and boasts that no one will be able to stop him after he kills Bullock and Montoya, apparently forgetting that the Bat family are a thing. Barbara changes into Batgirl during this scuffle and just kicks Clayface in the back. This sends him out the window and into the skating rink below.
I mean, Clayface was kind of confident. He's like, I'm a B-lister. They got better things to do right now. I'm just stealing a couple necklaces. It's not going to be a problem. She's like, I put off Christmas shopping until the last possible second.
And also in the first three seasons of Batman the Animated Series, Clayface is very much a tragic figure. In this, he's just boosting merchandise from department stores. It is a bit beneath him.
I thought this was just a different one. I didn't think this was the actor one.
Yeah, so actor Clayface is my favorite, especially from the Harley Quinn show.
You don't say.
I love the thespian.
Okay.
It's okay, you don't have to like him.
Montoya and Bullock arrive at the rink and, with a little guidance from Batgirl, shoot the Santa.
You wouldn't.
Succeed in halting the giant shapeshifter by way of shooting the electronic Santa display above and just shocking him into submission. Bullock is ready to close the case and celebrate now that Frosty the Lawn Cigar is taken out, as he puts it. Montoya reminds him that they still need to rummage through Clayface's body and recover the stolen goods.
Oh my god, I just got that joke. It has been years.
Bullock starts rolling up his sleeves for the grim job ahead as we fade out.
I didn't get that as the show was going either. I needed the explanation.
Alright, then we cut to our next vignette, December 31st. In Commissioner Gordon's office, Batman and a different Robin have just reviewed a taped broadcast by the Joker, who reveals some good news and bad news. He says that his New Year's resolution is to not kill anybody, but that means that he's going to have to kill a whole lot of people on New Year's Eve to make up for it. Well, as Bruce Timm loves to point out, their Joker never seems to kill anybody, no matter how hard he tries.
There's a dead man in the pictures.
Sort of.
Sorry, it's fine. But maybe...
Hey, those corpses were tied up. That's plausible deniability.
No, but they're going through crime scene with, like, there's, like, a body outline in one of the pictures, yeah, and then you see the Joker face.
Yeah, there's a chalk drawing, and yeah. I mean, whenever somebody gets Joker venom in the first three seasons, it never quite kills them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. No, those guys' eyes were yellow, Ryan.
Yeah,
they were dead.
They were probably dead. And then Gordon tells Batman that the only killing that day was a Goth Corp scientist who specialized in Sonic. So Joker got one guy.
Yeah, and now he's got the Joker face.
Yeah, this Dr. Erickson had been working on a Sonic-based weapon powerful enough to kill anybody within several miles.
Just like a total Adam West kind of villain.
Yeah, using some rudimentary deductive skills, Batman concludes that the New Year's Day countdown at Gotham Square is assuredly the place where Joker will set off the bomb. And yes, the Joker is setting up, with Batman close at hand, but the Joker has prepared a massive plastic Joker mask to help him blend in with the crowd, despite the crowd knowing that this is the visage of Gotham's most famous serial killer. They all seem to just go along with wearing the mask.
They're like, yeah, thanks for the free mask, dude, it's New Year's.
I maintain, if you're in the middle of a crowd that large and somebody's handing out supervillain masks, are you gonna try to run away and get stomped by a crowd, or are you gonna just put on the mask and enjoy the last few moments of life you have left?
I don't know that I would enjoy it.
Anyways, using his batinoculars, Batman easily spots the Joker. He's a huge clown wearing earmuffs on the other side, playing piano on stage. So just before swooping in, he makes his presence known with a well-timed batarang to the head.
Which is such a bitch move, because like he's like, and then like a half minute later, I'll get there. He's just like, no more piano.
Yeah, speaking of the art direction for this, and just how more tightly edited the new Batman Adventures is than, say, the first season of Batman the Animated Series, just like all of the hits in that, they still make me wince. Especially when Joker hits Batman in the head with a pail of champagne.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a shattering sound, and like it's like a metal bucket, and the champagne bottle's still solid, so I'm like, that's Batman.
Yeah, like I actually grimaced a little bit.
But I every time he gets hit in the back of the head with that stupid battering, I laugh though. That was so good. He's like, ah!
Well, like, and like the motion that his body made when he flew forward was so good.
Yeah, as the bell is rising to ring in the new year, which is where the Sonic device is, the Joker is having one final gloat by standing next to Batman with a bottle of champagne. The ever-alert Dark Knight, however, snatches the bottle and sprays it all over the controls, shorting the wires and eventually exploding the bell's pulley, resulting in a falling, massively heavy bell. This bell lands right on top of the Joker, which incapacitates him instead of just mashing him into paste. Because, you know, it's still a kid's cartoon. And then we get to January 1st. At 2 a.m., Gordon enters Joe's Tavern and has a seat, while the barkeep ushers out the remnants of the punters. He speculates that Batman might not show up after the hectic day he's had, but the commissioner is certain that Batman will not break their tradition. Naturally, Batman comes in, and they share a brief cup of coffee while they talk about looking forward to the coming events of the next year. Gordon turns aside to order a cheesesteak to go, but then finds that Batman has slipped away, as he usually does whenever Jim Gordon turns his head. Rude. Gordon swears that one day he will beat Batman to the check, because Batman also left money behind, and then heads home with a Batman swinging behind him.
And no cheesesteak.
I know, he doesn't even get his cheesesteak.
You know, I think it's kind of nice that Batman's paying the bill every year, because he clearly knows how much Commissioner Gordon is making.
After Fox's broadcast rights to Batman the Animated Series expired, Warner Brothers was eager to rerun the show as a programming block on the Kids WB with Superman the Animated Series. They approached Tim about creating new episodes of Batman on top of rerunning the old ones, which Tim's crew worked on alongside Season 3 of Superman and the preliminary stages of Batman Beyond. Tim remarks that was a very hectic year. Batman was redesigned from the top down, reflecting the lessons learned from producing the three seasons of the original show and the more sleek and stylized Superman show afterwards. Batman himself became more broad and bulky, and they took away the blue highlights from his cape, which I have mixed feelings about, but that obviously made him easier to animate.
And he looks more like a funnel.
Yeah, and they gave him pouches on his bat belt instead of the little capsules, and they got rid of the yellow oval. And also, they took away Bruce Wayne's brown suit, gave him a black suit, and pulled his hair back a little bit, and also made the difference between Bruce Wayne's voice and Batman's voice a little closer. They're less distinct from each other, which I thought was a bad move.
I mean, I don't mind that as much, but I did really like the sleek suit. Like, he does look like he might be a billionaire now.
That brown suit was a little dumpy on him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, times change. Years passed.
However, the main reason why Batman became more stern was because another decision was made to expand his supporting cast and focus more on them. They thought it would be more effective as a storytelling device to have a dichotomy between, you know, grimdark Batman and the more carefree and jokey Batgirl and Robin and Nightwing. A toy line was planned for the new Batman adventures, and the animation team was asked to make Batgirl more prominent in the show because they wanted to promote her action figure.
Yay!
Animators usually hate taking notes from the toy people, but everyone on the crew really liked Batgirl, so they happily complied.
Yay!
And in most episodes, Batgirl is Batman's main partner and not Robin.
Which I was happy with as a kid. It was kind of nice to have, like, you know, a girl in a show that wasn't there as, like, flashing violet eyelids at people, and that was all she did. Like, it was nice. She solves crimes.
Yeah, I like it.
Melissa Gilbert voiced Batgirl in Season 3 of Batman the Animated Series, but she was recast with Tara Strong because producers wanted a younger-sounding voice.
I love Tara Strong, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tara Strong has a million credits. She's basically voicing our entire childhood. Batgirl was given a yellow cape to make her resemble her Silver Age comics aesthetic a little more closely. Dick Grayson had left Batman to go solo as Nightwing. There's an episode that tells why in flashbacks, with Lester continuing his performance in that role. A much younger Robin, voiced by Matthew Valencia, was added. He's called Tim Drake, but his persona and origin run a lot closer to Jason Todd.
So he's Tim Todd.
I guess so, but like, Denny and Tim both say that their Tim Drake is a meld between Tim Drake and Jason Todd. I think he's just straight up Jason Todd. Like, there's no detective skills, not really. There's little to no tech affinity. Everything that I identify with Drake is just not present in this version.
He was my first exposure to Drake, so...
Anyways, Paul Dini felt that it would be overly complicated for their Robin to be like the Tim Drake in the comics, where his father is alive, and he's going to high school, and he has this life outside of the Bat family.
That's what Batman Beyond is for.
So, having the Jason Todd origin, where he's caught boosting tires from the Batmobile, he's like, I like this kid's moxie.
I mean, it's still good. But no, they're working their way up to Batman Beyond. It's fine.
I love it.
Overall, Tim said that making this season of Batman was a lot easier than the 3 seasons he did for the Fox network, just because there were just fewer notes. The WB network trusted them a bit more. They said that an average episode for Batman the Animated Series on Fox would get just like 5 pages of single-spaced notes. Ugh. Not only censorship stuff, like you can't do this, you can't do this, but they would also just like be trying to give them unwanted advice over what storytelling points to make. Conversely, they would get notes back for every episode for the WB, but it was just like a paragraph or two.
Maybe you don't show somebody get shot in the face, guys. It's a good show.
Maybe shoot his arm instead.
Well, one anecdote I remember is that there's an episode where Batgirl gets dosed with fear gas and she hallucinates that she dies. Commissioner Gordon finds out that she's Batgirl and he essentially declares war on Batman in revenge.
I remember that line.
And her death scene is her being knocked off a ledge by the Scarecrow. And in the original script, she hits the ground.
Oh! Ah!
And the WB was like, no, that's too intense. Do something else. So they instead of her hitting the street, she hits the windshield of Commissioner Gordon's car as it's approaching the scene. And they were shocked that WB found that acceptable because they're like, that's so much worse.
So much worse. I feel like anytime they're told, no, you can't do that, you have to do something better, they're like, okay.
We'll do something better.
We're going to give you a visual that sticks with these kids for their whole lives.
Another example of this is in the 3rd season of Batman the Animated Series, when they're doing Robin's origin episode and the flashback of the Flying Graysons dying.
Falling Graysons.
Oh my god.
The Graysons are not depicted as falling. Every time they stage something, Fox would give them notes back saying, no, that's not allowed, you need to do something else. So instead of depicting the Graysons falling, they just did a single shot of the cut rope dangling.
I remember that. It was so terrible.
That's
again,
so much worse.
It's worse. I remember that. It sticks in my brain.
Anyways, this episode, Holiday Nights, adapts 3 stories from the 1995 Batman Adventures Holiday Special comic book. It was written by Paul Dini, with art by Bruce Timm, and show animators Ronnie Del Carmen, Glenn Murakami, and Kevin Altieri. The only story from that comic that is not adapted into this episode is White Christmas, where Mr. Freeze breaks out of Arkham in order to visit Nora's grave and create a snowstorm over her headstone.
Aww!
He's processing.
processing. That makes me sad.
This is probably cut for time, but also in a rare break in continuity between the tie-in comic and the show itself, Nora is alive in the cartoon.
Oh, right, because Batman was like, yeah, you can have money.
Yeah, she was rescued from her stasis in the not very good Sub-Zero movie, and in an episode of the new Batman Adventures, Mr. Freeze is shown as abandoning Nora because his body is degenerated to the point where he could no longer be a warm and affectionate lover to her. There are a couple of differences between the comic and the episode, although it's a fairly faithful recreation. In the comic, Batgirl breaks into a changing room, and her transformation to the Batgirl is depicted a little more literally. You see less in the episode, probably for kids' television reasons. And also, in the original script for the comic, Bullock and Montoya apprehending Clayface ends with a not very tasteful joke about Montoya's skimpy elf costume in the cold weather. Denny himself decided to drop that from the comic, saying that that was in poor taste.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He was a little ashamed of himself for thinking that one up.
Yeah.
Anyways, the drunk singing Auld Lang Syne at the very end of this episode are caricatures of Bruce Timm, Murakami, and animator Shane Kleins.
I love when they do that.
Yeah, whenever Timm or Denny show up in Batman the Animated Series, it is not in very flattering ways.
They look like weird monsters.
Well, we wanted to keep singing.
I mean, my favorite is the episode where Harley Quinn is interning at Arkham Asylum in the flashback, and Paul Dini is in one of the cells licking the window.
When Poison Ivy makes a family, aren't there like weird cactuses of one of them?
Yeah, those are caricatures of Bruce Timm. And I remember listening to the commentary for that episode, and like some fan who won a contest to be on a commentary was with them. And he was like, hey, Bruce, what did you think of them making you into the cactus monsters? And he's like, holy shit, they did that. You guys are jerks. Anyways, this episode was directed by Dan Reba, and it was written by Paul Dini, obviously, because he wrote the comic. Reba directed several dozen episodes of the Super Mario Super Show and the ALF cartoon before he came on here. He became a DC Animated Universe mainstay, with many episodes across Batman, Batman Beyond, Superman, Zeta Project, Static Shock. He directed elements of Mask of the Phantasm, the Justice League cartoons, all over the place. He's a regular name.
DC, get on the Mask of the Phantasm movie, come on! Sorry. It is very interesting. I do like the list, but you got me all excited.
Anyways, the last episode we're talking about is Comfort and Joy, Justice League Season 2, Episode 23, first broadcast in 2003.
Question for you. Does the Ultra Brainiac always wear that outfit?
Ultra Humanite, and yes.
Sorry. Oh my god, that'd be terrifying. Just add Brainiac onto that. Is he supposed to look like Sean Connery from that sci-fi movie?
Okay, you've lost me.
The one that we watched with the giant head that threw up guns.
Zardoz?
Yeah, is he supposed to look like Zardoz? Like he's wearing a Zardoz cosplay?
No, that Ultra Humanite design actually predates Zardoz. I think it's from the 50s or maybe the early 60s.
He's been wearing the same loincloth outfit since the 60s.
Well, as I mentioned before, the Ultra Humanite is Superman's first recurring villain. He was this evil, bald, mad scientist type. Towards the end of his short run in the very first year or two of Action Comics, he developed the technology to switch his consciousness into other bodies. He was last seen in the Golden Age of comic books, plummeting into a volcano after possessing a sexy actress who's clearly intended to be Greta Garbo. And then he comes back as an albino gorilla decades later.
So before the gorilla, he wasn't wearing the loincloth.
Yes, yeah. The loincloth is specifically for the Ultra Humanite as an albino gorilla.
I don't think that loincloth would have fit Greta Garbo.
Anyways, the plot for this. On an alien planet, the Justice League work together to assemble a machine that resembles the Death Star to a degree, but it will prevent an ice planet from colliding with another inhabited planet, saving its population. The mission is a success, and the League looks forward to taking a Christmas break, except for John Jones and Hawkgirl, who are unfamiliar with Earth's customs and don't really understand what the appeal is. This leads to Green Lantern chasing down Hawkgirl after noticing the beauty of the ice planet and just hanging around. He decides to show Hawkgirl the fun of playing in the snow, and they build a snowman. Hawkgirl isn't super into snow angels for some reason.
I mean, I love their flirting. Like, that was one part of, that I forgot about how great Justice League was.
And they have an increasingly more elaborate snowball fight.
Which is so cute and quirky. You really get, like, a good Green Lantern kind of creativity from it.
As they mentioned for the show, Bruce Timm felt that since Jon Stewart's a Marine, he shouldn't be going, like, too elaborate and weird with the constructs. He should be more efficient. But, you know, he's being playful here, so you get a few hands.
Yeah, they were really fun at the end, and that's how he won. He got the upper hand.
Anyways, after their snowball fight, Hawkgirl decides to show Green Lantern her idea of a celebration, taking him to a rough bar on an outlying alien moon. She picks a fight with one of the patrons, attributing her mace smash to Green Lantern, which starts a huge playful brouhaha, and it ends with Hawkgirl dozing off into the arms of Green Lantern and their big burly assailant.
I know, that's my favorite part, that he's holding both of them.
With giant arms wrapped around them.
And she kisses him on the cheek. It's very sweet.
Yeah.
All right, the Flash's subplot for this is that he makes his annual visit to the Central City Orphanage to ask the kids what they want for Christmas. They eagerly show him a commercial for a hot toy of the moment, like the Tickle Me Elmo or Cabbage Patch Kids of the era. DJ Rubber Ducky, who raps and farts.
Yeah, it's pretty much Poochie from The Simpsons.
Oh my god, so accurate.
Flash finds that all of the stores are sold out, and he runs directly to the boy's manufacturer in Japan, managing to get the last one, just, you know, getting into the good graces of the owner. Returning to Central City, he's distracted by the Ultra Humanite, who is on a destructive rampage through a modern art museum.
How dare they call that art, Ryan?
I guess the Ultra Humanite is not super into everything that happened after the Impressionism era. In the ensuing fight, the toy is destroyed when the Humanite falls on it, and Flash is devastated. Touched by the Flash's Christmas spirit, the Humanite calls a truce after hitting Flash in the back of the head with his gun.
He did ask him. He said, you might as well use that. I couldn't feel any worse. And he's like, okay.
And he's also, you hit me first. Anyways, the Humanite agrees to fix the toy and surrender himself. He accompanies Flash to the orphanage, although he wants to go to jail quickly after this. He's humiliated by the idea of wearing a top hat and saying that he's a snowman. Flash is surprised to find that the Ultra Humanite has modified the toy, which now is reciting a narration of the Nutcracker Ballet, the Dumas version, in case you were wondering.
Ooh, I wasn't, but thank you.
Feeling that he needs to intervene on John's loneliness and lack of Christmas spirit, and also because Batman all but begged to do monitor duty during the holidays, Clark insists that John accompanies him home for the holidays at the Kent family homestead.
Just a point of clarification, this is the Martian Manhunter John.
Yes. Clark's parents, Jonathan and Martha, welcome him, but John feels slightly uncomfortable. He takes a walk on the streets of Smallville on Christmas Eve and is gradually impressed by the cheerful friendliness of the passerbys. He telepathically hears a little girl question the existence of Santa Claus, so he decides to fly up and land on her roof and make some noise and reach down in the chimney to eat some Oreos.
I think he was in it for the cookies.
His final stop is a church where the people inside are singing carols. Alright, after the Ultra Humanite returns to jail, Flash thanks him for his help with a Christmas tree, an aluminum one, that turns out to be the one that the Ultra Humanite had as a child before he engaged upon his career of supervillainy.
Villainous gorilla
gorillery.
Clark awakens on Christmas Day and listens to his parents as John, who has reverted to his natural Martian form, singing a Martian hymn in his native language while caressing Streaky the Super Cat. Streaky was initially skeptical of the Martian's existence and hissed at him, but John won her over.
Honestly, I love the part where he first sees the cat and you have that, like, deep, serious voice going, "Kitty."
Every episode of Justice League is a two-parter except for this one. This is the only standalone episode in the series. There are a bunch of random cameos in this one, although the most prominent is Martian Manhunter's 1950s comics animal sidekick Zook. He has a cameo as a stuffed animal on Supergirl's bed.
That's what that terrifying foot monkey was.
Is that what that horrifying
was?
Thing was?
Yeah, you both thought that horrible monkey orange guy was
horrible. Oh, I hate
horrible.
It.
Yeah,
no,
it was horrible.
It was bad.
Yeah, the Martian Manhunter hasn't had a team up with Zook in a very long
Good.
While.
That if they used him again, they need to redesign him. That was terrifying.
The script for this one was also by Paul Dini. Direction was by Butch Lukic. Lukic came on during Superman, and he directed for Doom Batman Adventures, Batman Beyond, Static Shock, Justice League, and Justice League Unlimited.
Yay!
One thing I wanted to highlight was Phil LaMarr and Maria Canales Barrera as Green Lantern and Hawkgirl, respectively. I really like their performance in this one. I think they play off each other very well. Mm-hmm. Tim very much resisted a romantic pairing between Superman and Wonder Woman that certain Warner Brothers executives and lots of people in the fan community all but demanded from him.
No, Wonder Woman with Batman, damn it.
Tim felt that Superman only had eyes with Lois, and doing a romantic subplot between Superman and Wonder Woman would be weird and inappropriate and gross to him.
I like the fact that it's like never gonna happen between Bruce and Wonder Woman and like Diana. That's my favorite part about that relationship, like their flirting, is that it's like impossible.
Instead, Tim had Wonder Woman flirt with Batman.
Which is better.
That's the right way to do it.
I think the scene where they first evince an interest in each other is very well executed and adorable, if you remember how it was established.
No, I don't remember.
Okay, it was in an episode where the climax is the destroyed building, and everyone gets out except Wonder Woman, who's trapped and buried in the rubble. Batman screams Diana and starts frantically scrambling through the rubble, and then a few seconds later, Wonder Woman busts loose because she has Superman's power set. She's fine.
Right? I was like, it's Wonder Woman.
But then Wonder Woman looks around and notices that Batman has gravel on his gloves, and then he sheepishly hides them behind his cape.
Aww.
And then
so cute.
And then she walks up to him and kisses him on the cheek, and he blushes.
Aww. It's good. It's good.
It's good.
But anyways, Tim decided to go on the unexpected route and develop something between Hawkgirl and Green Lantern and have that be the central crux of the romantic subplots for Justice League.
Which I loved so much. Also, it's my favorite Hawkgirl. I think that Hawkgirl's a really creepy character outside of this rendition of her.
In general, I like Shiera more than Kendra in most of their iterations. The whole reincarnation thing is... Ugh.
Oh, 100%. No.
Do I want to know?
No, let's not get into this episode running long enough to begin with.
Nobody likes Hawkman. Moving on.
Ew! Okay, going on.
But yeah, it made me think of the Avengers, specifically how the comics were written throughout the 70s and 80s. Generally, the heroes who had solo books, Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor, any of their major storylines would play out in their own books. So often, the central focus of Avengers in terms of the scripts were the B-listers. Hawkeye, Scarlet Witch, Tigra, Vision, Swordsman, so on and so forth. Those would be the most dynamic for characters for the title. They'd get most of the soap opera dynamics, all the interpersonal relationships and what have you. And while Justice League is less conducive for that, because while the Avengers can thrive with D-listers, most of the people, aside from Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis, seem to think that it isn't the Justice League unless you staff it exclusively with heavy hitters. But in this case, you can do a lot with the Martian Manhunter because he doesn't usually have his own book. And on this show, we don't have prior establishments for like Hawkgirl or Green Lantern. So I think he had a little more leeway with them so they could play around the way they did. And I do think that it really helped the show.
Oh, yeah. And like, it's also nice, too, when you take the big characters and push them off to the side a little bit.
Speaking of which, I wanted to highlight Carl Lumbly's vocal performance as the Martian Manhunter in this.
Kitty.
It was so good.
Going into this, I was a little older. I was a teenager. So I had read some Justice League comics and I already had an affinity for the Martian Manhunter. So it wasn't like, you know, growing up as a kid, Kevin Conroy's voice became my Batman and I heard that in his voice. I had a Martian Manhunter before this, but Lumbly pretty much instantly became the Martian Manhunter for me. He's the definitive take on the character as far as I'm concerned.
Yep, no, I'm there. That's good.
And yeah, he really gets the shine in this episode. There's just so many nice little moments for him where he grows into the sweater or...
Oh, it was so freaking cute.
And another thing I feel the need to point out is George Newborn as Superman in the Justice League episodes. For whatever reason, probably a scheduling conflict, Tim Daly couldn't be Superman on the Justice League cartoons and they had to find someone else. New Byrne is perhaps best known for voicing Sephiroth in Final Fantasy media.
Oh my god!
Some people don't especially like his Superman performance here, but I think he did a very nice job. I think I like Daly slightly more, but once again, New Byrne did fine here, and, you know, the bit where Clark is like, Santa wrapped the presents with lead foil.
Oh my god, that was my favorite part of the episode. He's just so quintessential Superman. It was Santa. Of course it was Santa. My parents wouldn't lie to me.
Yeah, for the first season, there was some internet fan nerd complaints about New Byrne's vocal performance. Tim rushed in to defend him and said, you know, if anything turned out wrong, it was mostly us, not him. We think New Byrne is a great Superman. And I do think that New Byrne vindicated himself as it kept through. And yeah, whenever Daly is unavailable from here on out, New Byrne essentially sets in to be Superman. He has voiced Superman as recently as 2022. And with that, that is everything I have written down about it. I usually have a thematic segment, but I don't know. This one is kind of fast and loose, and I wrote this very quickly, and I couldn't really think of anything else to say about it. I suppose I could ask, besides these three episodes, what are your favorite Christmas stories involving superheroes?
I mean, all I can think of are the Marvel ones, which doesn't seem very fitting right now.
And I could never really get into the Disney Plus Marvel shows, so I didn't see Hawkeye the whole way through. Some people really like it.
I really loved it. I thought it was really sweet and cute. And I also very much enjoyed the, what are they
called? Guardians of the Galaxy.
I loved the Guardians Christmas special.
I still need to see that.
I did watch that, and I did like it. Although, like, outside of the DC animated universe, I think my favorite Christmas superhero story is the Tig versus Multiple Santa.
Oh my god, I need to see this. Ryan, share with me.
It involves the Tick encountering a hoodlum who was trying to get away from a robbery by dressing in a Santa suit, but he gets electrocuted and gains powers where he can just, like, replicate himself like Multiple Man. So he starts doing these heists, and the Tick can't stop him because the Tick doesn't have it in him to punch Santa. So then the real Santa shows up and tasks the Tick with stopping the phony Santa. You see, Santa can only appear to people who believe in him, and the Tick, against all odds and sanity, still believes in Santa as a full-grown man, so that enabled it.
I mean, that's not surprising. That's the Tick.
And yeah, it's a really fun episode and worth revisiting if it's been a while since you've watched the Tick.
Do you have a least favorite animated episode, like, for, like, a Christmassy seasonal thing? I can pull one out immediately.
Okay, what do you have?
The Flintstones and the Jetsons Save Christmas.
Ew!
They both had the same plot. They just swapped one for the other. I don't like the Save Christmas ones.
There was a recent Reddit thread that went viral about people's least favorite Christmas tropes. There are some people who don't like Christmas sitcom episodes where they kind of destroy the veneer of it by having the parents buy presents and hide them under the tree. Like, if this is a family sitcom, kids are watching it and you're just ruining Santa for them. Although a lot of people complained also of episodes where it's just like, oh no, they don't believe in Santa, but then they bump into this kindly old man and it turns out that he's the real Santa and Santa's real.
I mean, I actually like the second one that you were talking about. I always think that's fun where it sees all cheeky.
Isn't that just
I'm usually a sucker for that too, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, going outside of comics, I can say one of my favorite Christmas specials is the Simpsons one where Bart accidentally melts all the presents.
We covered that on an earlier episode of this podcast.
Oh, that's funny. I love that episode.
I mean, in terms of superhero Christmas specials, the Christmas with the Morlocks from X-Men, the animated series.
Oh my gosh.
I love and hate that episode.
I remember that episode. I mean, to be fair, I kind of love and hate every episode of the 90s X-Men.
Yeah, I just have mixed feelings altogether. Although I do like that Jean and Gambit are fighting over kitchen space. That felt very real to me.
I try to avoid the kitchen on the holidays, but yeah, no, it's good.
Well, anyways, I guess that's good enough. We're over the 1 hour mark, so thanks for listening, everybody. Join us for more Christmas stuff.